From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Queen Akim in for Michael Krasny. In a speech before the United Nations General Assembly earlier today, President Donald Trump warned that the U.S. would destroy North Korea if leader Kim Jong-un continues to threaten the U.S. and its allies.
Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
President Trump also reaffirmed that he puts U.S. interests above all else. Coming up, we'll discuss the president's speech at the United Nations after the news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Queen Akim in for Michael Krasny. President Trump addressed the 193-country General Assembly of the United Nations earlier today, and in the speech, he warned of the grave threat from rogue nations, especially North Korea and Iran. The president concluded his speech with a call for the United Nations to fulfill its mandate and focus on results, urging a great reawakening of nations.
We need to defeat the enemies of humanity and unlock the potential of life itself. Our hope is a word and world of proud, independent nations that embrace their duties, seek friendship, respect others, and make common cause in the greatest shared interest of all, a future of dignity and peace for the people of this wonderful earth.
Joining us first to discuss the president's address is Somini Sengupta, United Nations Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Hey, Somini.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks, and thanks for coming on to Forum. So we have heard from observers on both sides that the Trump administration has yet to set out a clear vision of foreign policy and its global agenda. And there was a lot of anticipation with this address that he might add some clarity to that. Do you think the president did that today?
Well, he certainly did make a speech that was very high on nationalist sentiments. He was very clear that this was an America first foreign policy agenda. He said, as president, I will always put America first, just like you as the leaders of your countries will always and should always put your countries first. He used the word sovereignty repeatedly. I lost count at some point. And mind you, there's no sense that U.S. sovereignty is threatened at the United Nations. Indeed, the United States is a veto-wielding member of the Security Council, which is the most powerful body in the United Nations. So it does, always has, acted in its own national interest and in the interest of its allies.
So
this was a kind of extraordinary speech laying out sovereignty as the guiding principle.
Yeah, and I want to drill into that a little bit more in a sec, but I'm wondering, you're there at the United Nations, you saw him giving the speech in person. How was it received with the General Assembly?
Well, it's always hard to say how each and every country reacts to the speech of the American president. There was applause on that line that I just read out to you, you know, that I will always put America first, just like you will too. But it was unclear who was clapping there. Mm-hmm. So the principle of sovereignty is not exactly new at the United Nations. It's cited often by many countries like China or Syria or Venezuela. That's generally who you hear an assertion of sovereignty from. Sadly, I missed seeing exactly who was applauding there. However, when he started criticizing Iran, calling it a rogue nation, saying that the nuclear deal was embarrassing for the United States, it was clear that the Israeli delegation led by Prime Minister Netanyahu was very pleased by that remark.
He also went after North Korea, saying, calling the leader there, Kim Jong-un, Rocket Man, that he's on a suicide mission. He seemed to reaffirm this idea that America would be willing to attack North Korea, which, again, is one of these areas where there's been a mixed message because Secretary of State Tillerson, I believe, as well as defense, have both said that that they were willing to employ diplomacy. What did you take from that this speech and where America's policy is towards North Korea right now?
Well, I simply took what he said. He threatened to, quote, totally destroy North Korea, calling out its reckless, what he called its reckless pursuit of missiles and nuclear weapons, as you said, referring to Kim Jong-un as Rocket Man. Now, did he rule out negotiations? He certainly did not say that explicitly. So it's hard to say if, when he says that he is ready to totally destroy North Korea, does that mean that there will be no prospect of negotiating with North Korea? That's impossible for me to say. But he certainly did target these countries that we've already talked about, Iran, North Korea, Venezuela. Again, on Venezuela, it was a bit vague. He criticized the government of Venezuela as he has.
And before. Actually, let me stop you here for 1 second. And yeah. We're gonna play a clip real quick. And I would love to hear you come out of it. Here's a clip of President Trump at the General Assembly today in the United Nations, speaking about Venezuela.
The Venezuelan people are starving, and their country is collapsing. Their democratic institutions are being destroyed. This situation is completely unacceptable, and we cannot stand by and watch.
Now, this is sort of interesting because some of the folks who watch this space have said this is a very dicey game the United States is playing. Obviously, the United States has always been a big target for Venezuela, and wading into these waters might be a little risky in that it sort of creates this sort of reaction in Venezuela to be sort of anti-American and pro-Maduro. I'm wondering what your thoughts were of this as you were listening to him give this part of the speech.
Again, I thought that was quite imprecise, as these speeches can be, to tell you the truth. So he did say that the U.S. is, quote, prepared to take further action, but he didn't say what that action might be. What we didn't hear in his speech, I think, is also worth noting. There was hardly a word on Russia, although there was criticism of many of the Kremlin's allies, as we've already said, and there was really no mention of climate change or the Paris Agreement.
I think that thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today. I know you got to go and file your story. We have Somini Sengupta. She is the UN correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so we're going to go now to two other guests here to sort of dissect what happened today. We have Stuart Patrick. He's a senior fellow and director of the Program on International Institutions and Global Governance at the Council for Foreign Relations. He's also the author of The Sovereignty Wars, Reconciling America Within the World, and he writes a blog, The Internationalists. Hey, Stuart, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here, Quina.
We have a second guest, too, David Redney. He's the Washington bureau chief for The Economist. Welcome, David.
Hello.
So, Stuart, let me start with you. Can we take a step back, and can you give us a quick primer on the United Nations, what its mission is, and sort of its responsibility? Because I feel like I've got like a Schoolhouse Rock understanding of it, but I don't really know what they do.
Okay, I'll do that. I'm not going to do it to music.
All right, good, because we don't have any music for you. So.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, the United Nations was set up in the wake of the Second World War and on the heels of the failure of the League of Nations, which had been tried after World War I, to basically try to prevent or protect future generations from the scourge of war. And its most important, or at least most enduring function has been to try to mitigate conflicts around the world, particularly through the work of the Security Council, which Samini referenced, in which the United States has a veto power. But in addition to that, its agenda has expanded over the years to include advancing global health through an agency like the World Health Organization, for instance, dealing with new security threats like atomic weapons and their proliferation through the International Atomic Energy Agency, protecting refugees through the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. So there are a whole panoply of things, perhaps, 40 or 50 odd different agencies that are involved in things. Now, they're not always all that organized, which is one of the reasons why the president has aligned himself with a reform agenda at the United Nations. But in an extraordinary number of ways, the United Nations helps to bring collective goods to the international community and remains very, very important to the United States.
By the same token, I know you and others have echoed the president's comments today that the United Nations never really lived up to its mission. Can you flesh out that criticism a little bit more?
Sure. And I think this is inherent, really, in any international organization. One of the problems has been that certainly during the Cold War, it was the Security Council was deadlocked because of the confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union. But it is a place that is based on the principle of sovereignty, as the president rightly said today. And so all countries are coming there to use it as an instrument to advance their national interests. One of the problems is that particularly in the really big membership bodies like the UN General Assembly, where you take decisions on one state, one country, one vote, or the Human Rights Council, which operates similarly, you have you frequently get deadlock, and you get huge amounts of bureaucratic barriers to actually getting anything done. Sometimes there are ideological disputes between developing countries and developed countries. Sometimes there are disputes over values, like whether or not the Human Rights Council, which the president rightly called out today as often protecting abusers, is actually doing what it's supposed to do. That being said, even though it's frustrating, things like UN peacekeeping, where the United Nations has the largest deployed military force in the world of about 100,000 people helping stop slaughtering around the world. There are important things this institution does, but it's a constantly frustrating entity that's always in need of reform.
And David Remney, I'm wondering, are we seeing the UN reforming itself, and is the president getting enough credit for really pushing through this idea that seems to have resonance on all sides, that there needs to be reform at the UN?
Well, if you're an optimist, you will look at the last several months of U.S. action at the United Nations. You look at the United Nations ambassador, Nikki Haley, appointed by Donald Trump. She has been anything but a kind of wrecking ball saboteur. She's actually been very supportive of the UN Secretary General, has said quite a lot of warm things about Antonio Guterres, the former Portuguese Prime Minister, that he has a real reform vision that America can get behind. You can see like-minded countries in the UN kind of desperate, really, to prove that they can get behind this. They're giving her wins. They've been agreeing to review the budgets of kind of peacekeeping missions. Behind the scenes, actually, there has been the usual diplomacy where countries like France have resisted, the idea of slashing the peacekeeping budget. But where they've been able to find kind of savings that Nikki Haley can brandish and say, look, the UN is reforming itself, they've been trying to do that for her. So I think there is a kind of wary sense of relief among allies of America that their worst fears that Donald Trump's America First approach meant that he would sort of dismiss the UN or threaten to pull out of various UN bodies. Those have not been realized. But I think previous speakers have made the point that this was also a speech that claimed a kind of role for sovereignty and the strength of independent sovereign nations that really ignored the central tension that has dogged the United Nations since its founding, which is, on the one hand, yes, it is an assembly of sovereign bodies, but it also, in its founding documents, said that it believed in certain universal human rights and values. And that, anyone who's spent any time at the UN can tell you, has always been the central tension. When human rights and universal values bump up against claims of sovereignty from nasty dictatorships, which which wins. And Donald Trump essentially kind of completely sidestepped that today. He said that the world is a better and a safer place when proud sovereign nations put their own interests first. And that was essentially completely ignoring the lessons of history, that actually nationalism does not automatically lead to kind of world peace and good things happening.
And David Rennie, you are touching on something I wanted to ask you. Can you tell me how past presidents have used this speech at the UN General Assembly? It sounds like this sort of doubling down on sovereignty is not sort of the traditional path. How have past presidents used this address?
Well, it was a fascinating experience listening to Donald Trump speak today, because it was like listening to someone sort of speaking a language that isn't their own sort of mother tongue. So a lot of the things that Donald Trump said, if you kind of closed your eyes and sort of pretended a bit, he could have been a conventional, pretty hawkish, conservative Republican American president. I mean, lots of American presidents have said that America pays, you know, a very large share of the bill and would like to see reform. Lots of American presidents have called out dictatorships run by leaders who are hostile to America and have said that they're, you know, doomed to failure because they're oppressing their people and America stands for freedom. So those passages, when he was talking about Iran or when he was talking about Venezuela, that could have been any number of American presidents. But I think the reason I say it sounded like he was sort of speaking a language that's kind of not quite his own is you could tell that his heart was not really in the sort of internationalist idea of America as that kind of beacon of leadership to the free world. So, you know, if you think back to the great speeches of sort of Reagan, if you think back to George H.W. Bush, even George W. Bush after 9/11, who clearly used speeches to the UN to talk about, you know, the war on terror and the axis of evil, Trump was fundamentally saying something different, very Trumpian, about a much more kind of nationalist, American-driven vision about the people who had elected him.
And closing my eyes, I sort of felt like for parts of this that I could have been at a Trump rally. It seemed very much that his parts of his speech were directed towards his base. And as we all know, this is a more nationalist president than we've seen in the United States for a while. And Stuart Patrick, you had said that perhaps this could be a moment that President Trump, his speech here at the UN, could sort of be like Nixon goes to China, that he did he fulfill that goal for you?
You know, I think he came close to doing it. I mean, there, one, you know, you had this spectacle. Everybody was anticipating the most nationalist-minded president in generations. In some ways, perhaps even a pre-World War II president, in terms of his mindset, in terms of, you know, never using the terms American global leadership, using the phrase America first during the time of American isolationism. And yet here he was going into the temple of globalism. I think he actually threaded the needle relatively well with respect to reminding everyone that sovereignty is not the enemy of the UN, and again, that the UN is founded on the principle of sovereignty. But David is absolutely right that there are universal values also that have increasingly come to the fore. And the president, when he was talking about some of these rogue nations, it was interesting. On the one hand, he had phrased his comments as, well, we respect the sovereignty of other countries. We're not going to tell them how to live their lives. We're not going to try to remake them in our own image. And yet, in certain cases, he kept repeating, whether it was Venezuela or Iran, about how these countries treat their people. And so there was this question, well, is he going back to the view that the United States simply is this beacon, this city on a hill that watches you know, it's the well-wisher of freedom everywhere, but the vindicator only of her own, which is basically a line that isolationists frequently use? Or is it the redeemer nation that's actually going to go out there and try to correct the world's wrongs? And I have to say that with respect to calling out North Korea and Iran as being, he didn't call them an axis of evil, but he called them the wicked few. And here I actually saw echoes, I heard echoes from George W. Bush, a very Manichaean view of the world, but also a very selective one. He didn't call out our friend General Sisi in Egypt, for instance, who also abuses his people.
And it was interesting, the juxtaposition he made with his visit to Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states and other Gulf states, and this fight on terrorism, because as we know, with the 9/11 bombings, that many of those, the folks who were responsible for that came from Saudi Arabia, and many news reports about how there's a pretty big extremist group there of extremist Muslims.
Yes, if I can, I mean, if I can pick up immediately on that, you know, he said in dealing with terrorism, but also some of these other challenges like North Korea and Iran, he said, you know, you cannot be a bystander. There's no room for bystanders, which sounds very much like you're either for us or against us. And so, and that implies, in a sense, sort of a universal goal that all countries should have. But as Somini pointed out at the top of the show, you know, he didn't say anything about the threat that most countries now see as perhaps the most existential, which is climate change. He didn't say anything about their goals. So the question is, he's expecting other countries to rally to the causes he's identified and prioritized, but is he willing to rally to their causes?
We are talking to Stuart Patrick. He's with the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of The Sovereignty Wars, Reconciling America with the World. And we're also speaking to David Rennie of The Economist. If you want to ask us any questions on Trump's address, if you have comments, we'd love to hear what you thought of the address. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or you can email your questions to forum@kqed.org or post them at kqed.org/forum. David Rennie, I wanted to talk to you about or ask you this question, which is, you know, there's always been tension between the United States, at least our officials, and the UN. Many of the things that Trump is outlining have been talking points before, and yet the United States always seems to sort of go back to the UN, and it's been noted that the biggest sort of diplomatic victories that the president has had with his term have been through Nikki Haley and the deal she's been able to forge with North Korea. Can you talk a little bit about that tension of the love-hate relationship?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is where an America First campaign slogan runs kind of like a freight train into the brick wall of reality, which is, if you look at Donald Trump's intray, at the very top of his national security intray is the threat from North Korea and its nuclear program, and pretty close to the top is Iran and keeping them to the nuclear freeze agreed in the international agreement under Obama. The problem that an America First president has when those things are at the top of your intray is the only real hope of stopping North Korea from developing the worst thing, which would be nuclear warheads that fit on the top of a ballistic missile that can hit Washington, D.C. That's the kind of the nightmare scenario. The only real hope of stopping that happening is for a lot of powerful countries and regional neighbors of North Korea to work together to isolate that regime. Now, even that might not work, but basically isolating and quarantining the world's most dangerous rogue states.
David Rennie, I'm going to stop you right there, and I would love to pick up on this when we get back, but you are listening to Forum. We are discussing President Donald Trump's address to the UN General Assembly earlier today. I'm Queenie Kim, and stick with us. We'll have more after the break. Welcome back to Forum. We're discussing President Donald Trump's address to the UN General Assembly earlier today. We are speaking to Stuart Patrick. He's with the Council on Foreign Relations, and David Rennie. He's with The Economist. David, I cut you off there a little bit about this tension between loving and hating the United Nations. You're talking about North Korea and how, despite this idea of, you know, preemptive strike or going after North Korea, really it's hitting this reality that we need North Korea's neighbors to help or at least support us in this role. And would love you to pick up your thought.
Yeah, so if you accept that there isn't a military option that doesn't risk kind of unbelievable casualties, not least because the South Korean capital, Seoul, is basically under artillery kind of range from North Korea, and you'd have this kind of appalling bloodbath if you actually had a fighting match, a shooting war with North Korea. So the alternative is for America to talk to, above all, China and try and isolate North Korea. If you're trying to isolate rogue regimes, You need allies. Mm-hmm. You need coalitions. And I think that's what you heard from Donald Trump today, was he was sort of talking of the United Nations as a kind of Congress of Vienna, if you like. It's a kind of cockpit where the world's sovereign, proud nations come together, respecting the self-interest of their own people, and work to isolate terrorists or rogue regimes. It's a very kind of old-fashioned, as Stuart said, almost kind of pre-World War II. I mean, you could even go back to the 19th century or the Congress of Vienna, that idea of kind of the big countries of the world coming together and sorting out rogue states among themselves. That was his pitch, I think.
You can join us in the conversation at 866-733-6786 or email us at forum@kqed.org. You can also tag us on Twitter. We're at KQED Forum. And pivoting from North Korea, I wanted to go into Iran. We're going to play a little clip here of the president's speech at the United Nations.
The Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into. Frankly, that deal is an embarrassment to the United States, and I don't think you've heard the last of it. Believe me.
Stuart Patrick, I found this sort of interesting because I think there is a certain impulse that people felt with North Korea that maybe the United States was being too passive and that we should sort of go in there. And now that all options are on the table, we're sort of realizing there's a reason why past presidents have taken this option of sanctions and not going to that threat level. It feels like that same lesson should be learned in Iran. Or what am I missing here?
Yeah, I think that the president was on a lot shakier ground in trying to rally the troops, metaphorically speaking, up at the UN against Iran, because his own administration last week actually recertified Iran as actually abiding by the terms of its nuclear accord. And the International Atomic Energy Agency, from what we know, their inspectors have suggested that it actually is complying. So I don't think there's a whole lot of appetite, not the least from our European allies, who, when this idea of rejecting the agreement was floated over about the last 10 days, just were vehement that the United States cannot abandon its allies, who actually believe that this agreement is still working, it's still in force, and it has Iran under control. The president also made a pivot, though, to suggest that maybe or imply that maybe one of the reasons why he was interested in getting rid of the agreement was because of the behavior that Iran is exhibiting in its neighborhood. Put it in the context of, in quote unquote, violating the sovereignty of Syria, for instance, in supporting Hezbollah and global terrorism worldwide. Again, I think most people will believe that those two issues have to be compartmentalized. We can continue to bash them with respect to their terrorism, but we should not let that upend what is an agreement that is basically holding back a nuclear arms race in the Persian Gulf region.
And David Rennie, it sounds like we're sort of hearing a similar sort of bifurcated message here. On the one hand, the president has tough talk. On the other hand, his heads of departments are cautioning and saying that there's diplomacy at work. I'm wondering, there seems to be this bad cop, good cop dynamic, but is there a risk of the president sort of coming off as he's crying wolf, that he's sort of promoting these tactics and strategies that everybody sort of knows is a dead end? Or thinks
well,
he's a dead end, I guess.
So you're right to talk about crying wolf, and I guess in the field of kind of geopolitics, we've been used to the idea of, is it a good idea or a bad idea for presidents to draw red lines? That's been a big thing for the last few years. Remember how President Barack Obama was criticized for talking about a kind of red line when it came to Syria and the regime there using chemical weapons, and then he did not enforce that, in part because he asked Congress, and Congress said no, they didn't want to do these limited strikes. So there is an idea that it's very dangerous for the world's most powerful country, America, to set red lines that it can't meaningfully enforce. I think one thing that's really interesting about Donald Trump, and it's not a very cheerful thing, is that actually another American president who had taken the podium and talked about totally destroying North Korea or, some of the very kind of bellicose things that he said would have caused panic. But there's an element now where people shrug because it's Donald Trump, because everyone is used to the idea of, a morning tweet in which he talks about you know, being locked and loaded or sending fire and fury to North Korea. And the idea that it may not mean quite the same thing for Donald Trump to say that. So if we were judging him by the same rules that we judged every other American president, he's been drawing red lines all over the place. But we somehow understand that, as you say, his advisors, who come from a different kind of worldview, they come out and sort of explain what he really meant, and perhaps not quite as terrifying as the thing that he just said.
Well, let's go to some comments here. Tom writes about Trump's speech. What a great speech. We finally have an American president working for the American people. Obama was more concerned about the UN and other countries' issues. And I wanted to go to you, Stuart Patrick, about this. There's been a lot of conversation about how the United States is sort of turning inward with, you know, the idea of make America great again. And at least in his rhetoric, he seems to be ceding the global arena to other powers? Or are there other powers that are sort of stepping up, and are we seeing this creating a vacuum for other countries to step up into the leadership role?
Yeah, I understand Tom's perspective, but I guess what I would say is that with respect to Barack Obama, I think the argument that folks in that administration would make was that, frankly, we live in an age of interdependent threats in which, whether you're talking about the potential of pandemic Ebola getting to the United States or a nuclear weapon smuggled into a container ship into Oakland Harbor, you really have to work with others to try to deal with that. And his whole emphasis, the president's was, past president's was, rules must be obeyed. And so in that regard, I think that the people in the Obama administration would say he really did put the United States, he did put America first in his own way. I do think that there is a danger with respect to Donald Trump's unpredictability and potentially, as we were just discussing, the lots of bluster that's not necessarily backed up of both miscalculation and also a loss of American credibility in the world. Mm-hmm. What we begin to see is some hedging, because longtime allies, whether they're NATO allies who have been dismissed and dissed, as it were, allies in Northeast Asia, when they hear a lot of bluster, and particularly when they haven't necessarily been consulted, as I'm sure the South Koreans weren't, about destroying North Korea, it makes a possibility of what political scientists call hedging behavior, where you try to hedge your bets a little bit, and maybe you cozy up to China within the United Nations, or maybe you see what the Russians have on offer. I think that that's very dangerous for anybody who believes that the United States should be a steadying force in the international system.
Yeah, because I can imagine if the president's talking about bombing North Korea, which we all assume means North Korea will bomb South Korea, South Koreans are going to be looking for some new friends, maybe, to protect them. But we have a call here from Deborah. She's from Durango, Colorado. Hey, Deborah, welcome to Forum.
Good morning, everyone. I have just 2 points. One is that when President Trump was talking today at the UN about sovereignty and American nation interests, and then talking to Venezuela about their treatment of human people, and, the moral authority seems really confusing and ambiguous, which leads me to my second point. I was a military wife for 17 years, and my first husband's in Arlington. And when I was living on a CB base getting ready for the first Gulf War, well, I wasn't getting ready. He was getting ready for the first Gulf War. And I remember all of the activity and the diplomacy and the international community. And so would you have a morally ambiguous message about American interests and then a confusing State Department that seems really vacant at the moment? It's concerning, and I wonder what you guys think about that.
David Rennie, do you want to take that question?
I think those are two really absolutely brilliant points that get to the heart of the problem with this administration and with this speech. The first point about the double standards, I'm sure that one of the reasons that you heard only kind of scatter the pause when he was going after the government in Venezuela. Look, Venezuela doesn't have a lot of admirers in that room. Venezuela's government has, you know, totally messed up the economy, and Maduro is a very unimpressive leader. But there is a problem with attacking Venezuela for, shooting students in the streets or, having bad human rights, when everyone knows that he has not called out Russia for interfering with the sovereignty of its neighbors. He's not called out Putin for his human rights. He's not called out the Saudis, or as Stuart said, he's, you know, he's palling up to people like General Sisi, the essentially authoritarian leader of Egypt. So there's a massive, obvious double standard there. And your second point about the first Gulf War, and remember George H.W. Bush painstakingly getting the permission of the world and getting allies to agree not only to join the coalition but to pay for the removal of Saddam Hussein's forces from Kuwait. That was a model of exactly using the UN, because the idea was that the rules-based order that America had helped craft after World War II was a massive lever for American influence, that if you went in under the aegis of the rules-based order as the kind of global cop, as opposed to kind of Rambo or a kind of lynch mob, that you gained tremendous kind of not just moral benefits, but actually, you know, it maximized, it was a force maximizer. And I think Donald Trump, his speech today was much closer to that Rambo cowboy model than the global cop model.
Stuart Patrick, we have a question or a comment here that one of our listeners wrote in. It's, I guess, a bit of a sarcastic pushback on your climate change comment, and that is, climate change is more dangerous than Islamic terror? You have to be kidding. With Europe turned upside down with weekly attacks, the number two risk should be nuclear-armed states with no worry of mutually assured destruction. Climate change barely makes the top five.
Well, I think it depends a little bit on your time frame. It's not as if the world is going to end because of climate change tomorrow. But when you look at the numbers of people who will lose their places where they live, the massive migration that will occur, the potential collapse of global fisheries because of ocean acidification as well as coral reefs, the rendering of certain parts of the world uninhabitable, the loss of agricultural and arable land, as well as land for domestication of animals. It's truly a remarkable set of events that we have set in train. Now, terrorism, of course, is dramatic and it's awful. I do want to stress that the odds of an American getting killed by a terrorist are infinitesimally small. So if you just did a cost-benefit analysis of this, and if you were to link some of the major storms that we're seeing in the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean to climate change, as well as other extreme weather events, I think you'd actually, on even just taking the metric of human mortality, you might find that there's a lot to be said for that. I do agree, for taking it more seriously, I do agree that nuclear weapons do pose a horrifically existential threat, and particularly if they were linked with terrorism. But much of the terrorism threat so far has been wildly overblown.
That was Stuart Patrick. He's with the Council on Foreign Relations. We also have David Rennie on the line. He's with The Economist. And we are discussing President Trump's speech to the UN General Assembly earlier today. If you want to tell us what you thought about the speech, or if you have any questions, give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Or just email us at forum@kqed.org. And we have a call here from Wayne from Lafayette. Wayne, welcome to Forum.
Hi, thank you. My question is whether or not President Trump's behavior threatening to destroy North Korea will essentially back North Korea into a corner. And it strikes me as somewhat of a bullying type of practice that doesn't have any positive outcomes for anybody. And I'd be curious as to comments about, you know, how folks think that North Korea will respond.
And actually, let's hear what the president had to say about that before we get to our guests. Here's a clip from his speech at the UN.
The United States has great strength and patience. But if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea.
And David Rennie, we have another listener comment that sort of pings off the comment we just heard. And Noel writes, "We destroyed North Korea during the Korean War. Aren't Trump's remarks just more fodder for Kim to say he can't negotiate with the United States?" It sounds like these listeners are feeling like Trump is backing us into some sort of strange corner that nobody was really sure how to get out of.
Actually, I fear. I used to cover North Korea when I was based in Beijing. I've been to North Korea a couple of times. It's not like any other country I've ever reported from. There isn't a kind of a good North Korea waiting to be kind of cajoled into good behavior. That doesn't mean Donald Trump is not capable of saying bombastic things that are unhelpful. But actually, if you listen to what he said carefully there, he said that if America or its allies were attacked, then North Korea would face total destruction. That's a kind of blustery way of stating the classic principle of deterrence, which is if Kim gets a nuclear warhead onto a missile and attacks, Japan or American territory, North Korea is going to get hit with massive nuclear retaliation. I'm afraid, the truth is that North Korea's regime is hell-bent on getting these nuclear weapons. I don't think really anything is going to change it, and I don't think that there's much to the idea that, we're now scaring and provoking Kim into being more dangerous than he might otherwise have been. He is as bad and dangerous a ruler as it's possible to imagine.
We have a call here from Heather. She's from Rochester, Minnesota. Heather, you're on the line. Welcome to... I'm sorry. There was a mistake there. It's actually Don in Corte Madera. Don, welcome to Forum. Hello, Don? Okay, looks like... Oh, yes, go ahead.
Well, actually, it's Heather from Rochester. Thanks for taking my call.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, no, you're fine. I just wanted to bump off that other comment about climate change and that, ISIS could be more dangerous than that. In a lot of those places, climate change is happening. They're out of food. They're out of water. The migrations are happening. That's why people are fighting. So to say that climate change is irrelative or is more or less dangerous than what's happening is so, it is happening. And it's 7 billion of us. It's so essential to bring that up because people are out of food. People are out of water. Why wouldn't you fight?
I think our guest here, Stuart Patrick, made a similar point earlier. And I know you have to go, Stuart, but I'm wondering if you have a last comment about Trump's address or the listener comment.
Yeah, so actually, let me take the listener comment because I think it is fascinating. It's always hard to associate a particular event, whether it's a storm or whether it's a violent conflict, with climate change. I think one has to be careful of that. That being said, there's no question in the minds of many analysts who have looked at the origins of, say, the war in Syria, for instance, or the war in Darfur, or the situation in Yemen, which is one of the most water-stressed countries in the world, that these environmental scarcities and environmental stressors that occur can have really a devastating impact on life and livelihoods in those countries, and make the idea of actually taking up arms or competing with others over those shrinking resources really not only a viable option but an attractive option. So I think that it'll be interesting to see what goes forward in terms of the climate change agenda without the United States. But this is one of the reasons why other governments, including those of France under President Macron, are so determined that we need to keep pressing on this issue for not just for prosperity, not just for environmental goals, but for human security as well. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. That was Stuart Patrick. He's with the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also author of the book, The Sovereignty Wars, Reconciling America with the World. And he writes the blog, The Internationalist. Stuart, I know you got to go, but thanks so much for joining us on Forum.
Yeah, great pleasure. Hope to do it again soon.
Great. We still have David Rennie on the phone with us here. He's with The Economist. And I'm going to go to some of the listener comments. We have Robert writes, does the fact that Trump has lied numerous times affect how world leaders regard him? I feel like we've sort of addressed that. So I'm going to go on to the next one. This is Nicole. She writes, 45's a lunatic with delusions of invincibleness. He will inevitably provoke another war, which, from what I can tell, his party wants. His hyperbole makes for good TV and being the attention seeker he is. Trump thinks nothing of the lives lost and ruined, the environments decimated, or the economy shattered, as long as his ego is stoked by his supporters. I feel like that comment sits on his own. David, do you want to respond, or should we just go to the next one?
So just a couple of quick things. One is, actually, there isn't a war party in Congress kind of beating the drum for a war. That's the really striking thing. I think that Donald Trump is president of a war-weary country, and that is kind of bipartisan. I mean, compared to the rhetoric that you were hearing in Congress, you know, a decade ago, there are not a tremendous number of hawks suggesting that you can have a quick and easy war, or that people would be greeting American troops in foreign cities with kind of flowers of welcome. So I don't think that his party is egging him on. It's also a really interesting point that if the perception of that listener is that Donald Trump is this kind of ego-driven war hawk, remember how different this is from the Donald Trump of the campaign, who stood out from the Republican pack by criticizing what he thought was sort of dumb wars and promising to focus all his energies on nation building at home. And that really resonated with his base.
Yeah, and I was... You'd actually sort of reminded me that I'd actually almost forgotten that he had ran on this platform, that he was against foreign intervention and it's time for America to pull back. But before we get to that, I want to tell you that you are listening to Forum. We're talking with David Rennie. He is of The Economist. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information on how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Queenie Kim. So how do we square that then? I mean, I guess is it more just sort of this murky waters that we are seeing with this administration? The platform was one thing, not to be interventionist, and yet we hear a very hawkish president. Is there more to be said about that?
Well, Donald Trump has actually talked about this himself in quite interesting ways in recent days, particularly when he was talking about the number of troops that he was going to leave in Afghanistan. He said in public that things look different when you're taking decisions in the Oval Office, and that he had changed his mind, that he had come to office assuming that pulling back from the world was in the best interest of the United States, and he had been persuaded otherwise. I mean, I think we've been very critical of the speech, and I think overall it wasn't a brilliant speech, but there were little bits in there that actually, compared to the Donald Trump of the campaign, should reassure us. So he actually was trying in some ways to make the case for America paying into the UN budget. And he said at one point, you know, we do pay in this tremendous amount of money, but if we can achieve, you know, peace and avoid some of the world's worst problems, then that will be a good investment. That was not the language of Donald Trump on the campaign trail. That sounds a lot like the language of the guy who, when he sits in the Oval Office and sees what a very, very dangerous world this is, that actually working with other countries sometimes is a force multiplier for even superpowers like America.
We have a call here from Dean in San Francisco. Hey, Dean, welcome to Forum.
Hey, I just had a quick question. What kind of message are we sending North Korea when we're inviting them to, you know, come to the table for discussions? Meanwhile, we're saying that we're going to pull out of the Iran deal. It's kind of contradictory, isn't it?
That's actually, I hadn't actually really thought about that. That's a really good question. David Rennie?
That's a very good point. And you're seeing, you know, sort of people who were involved in setting up the Iran deal under Obama, you know, already on Twitter making exactly that point, that if America looks like it can't be trusted to stick to the terms of a nuclear deal, what message are you sending to North Korea? It's a good point. The only sort of pessimistic kind of note that I would add to that is the truth is that North Korea is a kind of problem of a kind of unique horror all by itself. And other presidents have tried nuclear deals where they basically bribed North Korea. Bill Clinton tried it. George W. Bush tried it. And North Korea took the money and cheated every single time. It doesn't mean it's not a good idea to try again, but North Korea is just sort of infinitely badly behaved and infinitely malign. And, you know, nothing really makes them any better or worse. They're just an appalling nightmare problem.
Well, I sort of wanted to drill into this notion that we've been talking about, President Trump sort of being very hawkish, going on the attack in public. You have people behind the scenes sort of urging diplomacy. Where is Secretary of State Rex Tillerson in all this? There's been a lot of talk that he's sort of been absent in these discussions or as a leader in the traditional role of Secretary of State. So then who is behind the scenes right now? Do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, so Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, is one of a kind of triumvirate of grown-ups, really. The other one is a very important figure is the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, former four-star Marine general. The two of them are the kind of public face of America often. They've been going around the world telling allies that actually, in effect, America is more normal than you think, and that America stands up for the rules-based order, stands up for free trade when it's on the right terms, has not overthrown things like NATO and that post-World War II order. The third member of that triumvirate is the Vice President, Mike Pence. And it's very interesting. I went on the Air Force 2 with Mike Pence, the Vice President, to Latin America recently, and his tour was basically Donald Trump had just said that there might be a military option in Venezuela. This caused huge consternation across Latin America. Mike Pence's job was to say, well, the president, when he said that, meant that we have many options, and of course we still have confidence that the final option will be a peaceful one, but we're very upset about the very bad situation in Venezuela. So we've got this triumvirate of grown-ups kind of explaining and parsing Trump to the world.
Well, we're running out of time here, but we've got one last comment from a listener that I wanted to share. Mark writes, I thought Trump's use of God bless America was totally out of place, and I'd bet those groans were coming from the Scandinavians when he said that socialism in any form has been a disaster everywhere that it's been tried. We are ending Forum right now. We've been talking about President Trump's speech to the UN General Assembly. On the line with us right now is David Remney of The Economist. We also had on Stuart Patrick. He's with the Council on Foreign Relations. And you are listening to Forum. I'm Queenie Kim, and please keep listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.